The last case on our calendar is 03-1325, State of Ohio versus Gerald Hand. Justice O'Connor has recused herself in this case, and we're very pleased to have sitting in place of Justice O'Connor, Judge Arlene Singer, who is a judge of the Court of Appeals sitting in the 6th Appellate District. Welcome, Judge Singer. Ms. Dotson.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. I ask to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal today.
You may.
Today, I will address the first proposition of law, and Hand's convictions and death sentences must be reversed because he was convicted with unreliable and inadmissible hearsay statements. The state's premise that Lonnie Welch was killed to cover up his involvement in two previous homicides rests solely on hearsay. No one was ever charged in these previous homicides, and the state is now trying to come in through the back door and use these two unsolved previous homicides to convict Hand in this case. The hearsay that was admitted in this case is extensive. There are over 20 statements through 8 different witnesses. And this hearsay was admitted under 804B6, which is a new rule in Ohio that was passed in 2001. And this evidence was admitted even though the two requirements of 804B6 were not met in this case. The two requirements are that there must be wrongdoing on the part of the defendant, and the wrongdoing was for the purpose to prevent testimony at trial. And in this case, there was no wrongdoing and there was no purpose to prevent the testimony at trial. Welch was not involved in the previous homicides and was therefore not a witness to these previous homicides. Again, no charges were filed and no prosecution was made as to these previous homicides. The physical evidence does not tie Welch to the first two scenes and in fact points elsewhere to an additional offender. The DNA from the second crime scene was found in gloves worn by the murderer that were thrown into a bush near the crime scene that were recovered at that time. They were tested both back in 1979 and for this case, and DNA was found in those gloves to match both Lori Hand and an additional person. And this additional person was not Lonnie Welch, and it was not Gerald Hand. This DNA belonged to someone else who committed this crime. Secondly, a blonde hair was found on Lori Hand's body. And this did not match her, and this did not match Lonnie Welch or Gerald Hand. Again, it points to someone else that committed this crime. There was no independent evidence of payouts from Gerald Hand to Lonnie Welch in either of the previous homicides. In the alternative, if Welch had been involved in these previous homicides, Hand lacked the specific intent to prevent his testimony at trial. Again, there were no charges for the previous homicides. Welch was not cooperating with the authorities, had never been investigated by the authorities for these previous homicides. And a court cannot ignore the requirement of 804B6 that it be for the purpose of preventing testimony. And there was no testimony to prevent in this case, as Welch was not cooperating with authorities or planning to testify in these cases. Hand did not know Welch was allegedly making statements about his involvement in these crimes. Over 25 years had passed since the first homicide, and Welch had never confronted Hand, threatening to testify about any alleged involvement in these crimes. And there, again, is no credible evidence of Hand's intent to prevent his testimony. This is also not enough to meet the A3 spec to count 2. As the state did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Hand was complicit in the previous homicides or the current crime. Again, the second part of 804B6, that there was wrongdoing on the part of the defendant, was not met in this case. This case is a bit unique in that Gerald Hand does not deny that he killed Lonnie Welch. However, the court cannot end its inquiry at whether Gerald Hand killed Lonnie Welch. The court must go on to examine whether this was a wrongful killing. And Gerald Hand killed Lonnie Welch out of self-defense, or at the very least, voluntary manslaughter. Again, if we look at the physical facts of the crime, the state cannot say how long Lonnie Welch was in this house or where he was in the house on the night of this crime. The forensics indicate that Welch was shot with a .38 from the hallway, which supports Hand's story that after dinner, he retired to the bathroom where he heard gunshots, ran into his bedroom, grabbed two .38s, came out into the hallway, and then fired upon an intruder in his home who had just killed his wife. Jill Hand was shot with a 32, and this 32 was shot, I'm sorry, was found in the yard with no prints on it and two shots fired. Lonnie Welch was wearing gloves that evening, and he also had gunshot residue on the trigger finger and thumb of his hand that would have held the gun, indicating he shot Jill Hand. And then Bob Hand shot Lonnie Welch out of self-defense, believing himself to be in imminent danger. The state itself concedes that this scenario is possible in response to another proposition of law in their brief, that a reasonable juror could find that Lonnie Welch did shoot Jill Hand and then Gerald Hand shot Lonnie Welch. And if the defense of self-defense does not extend beyond the house out into the driveway of the house next door, then at the very least, this is voluntary manslaughter on the part of Hand, and this is not enough to meet the wrongdoing requirement of 804b6. Under 804b6, the state must prove actual intent of wrongdoing to prevent testimony and not merely assert it. And this is very important in that b6 results in the forfeiture of confrontation rights, and that is a very fundamental right under the Constitution. The court went on to rule that not only were these statements allowable under 804b6, but that these statements were also reliable and admissible under both the Confrontation Clause and the Due Process Clause, and this was an error. Again, there were 20 statements through 8 witnesses, and each of these statements must be examined independently for reliability. And they are unreliable for two different reasons. They are unreliable because the witnesses themselves are unreliable, and they are unreliable because Welch's alleged statements themselves are inconsistent and contradictory and do not have guarantees of trustworthiness around their statements. First, the witnesses are unreliable for a number of reasons. They were motivated by vengeance. Their statements are inconsistent. There is an extensive criminal history and drug abuse history among many of the witnesses. And the witnesses' testimony changed not only from police statements to their testimony at trial, but even from the hearsay hearing, the pretrial hearsay hearings, to their testimony at trial, their statements changed. Again, the family was motivated by vengeance in this case. Lonnie Welch's brother, Shannon Welch, admitted to an extortion attempt upon the Hand family. Initially, when the police came to him asking why his brother would have been in the house in Delaware County, he stated he did not know. It was only after he made an extortion attempt for money upon the Hand family that he then went back to the police and said, "I have some information for you." He told other witnesses to talk to the cops after he heard that the case was not going well, and many witnesses admitted that they got together and filtered their stories about how they thought Hand was involved before going to the police. And this puts all of these statements into doubt. The statements themselves are inconsistent. Betty Evans was one witness. She is the sister of Lonnie Welch, and she testified that he had a lot of cash in the late 70s and early 80s. But then Barbara McKinney, his wife, and Shannon Welch's brother testified that no, he never had any cash. So the statements are inconsistent with each other. Some witnesses were caught in outright lies on the part of David Jordan, who was a jailhouse informant, said that he had been in prison with Lonnie Welch's brother, Shannon Welch, while they were both serving time, and he knew Shannon Welch very well. Well, when Shannon Welch was shown the picture of David Jordan, he did not know who he was.
Aren't all of these, or not all, but most of what you've been telling us are issues for the jury, are they not? There's a lot of credibility, so-and-so is lying, and inconsistent statements, but those aren't legal issues for us to decide, are they?
With hearsay, it is the court's duty to first examine the statements for reliability before they are admissible, because hearsay is presumptively unreliable. It is unlike other evidence, and in this case, the court must first do a reliability determination under Roberts before that they may be allowed into evidence. Again, the testimony of many of the witnesses changed from the police statements to the time when they testified. A good example is Teresa Fountain, who was a witness initially found to be unreliable by the court, and the court initially found her testimony to be not admissible under 804b6. The court then changed its mind, giving very little reason for doing so. She was very inconsistent about the year in which she heard Welch allegedly make statements. there was about an 8-year gap, but she was not sure when it took place. She couldn't say where she was in the apartment with accuracy. She initially told the police that she was in the bathroom when she overheard these statements he made to someone else in the house. That then changed to her being in the kitchen when she testified at in the pretrial hearing. And then that changed yet again when she took the stand to say, well, then I stuck my head out into the living room and then I heard these statements. Well, that's changed considerably from her first police statement. And she never mentioned to the police the second conversation she had with Welch in that he told her to keep her mouth shut about what she heard. This was not a statement that she, this was a new addition on the stand. This was not something she had told the police previously. In addition, Welch's statements themselves are immediately suspicious because it's an accomplice's confession that inculpates a co-defendant. And courts from Crawford on down have found these to be immediately suspicious because they try to shift blame and minimize culpability. Because why would someone confess to murder, even spontaneously, to family? Again, his statements are inconsistent in and of themselves. They do not match the crime scenes of the previous homicides. There is very little detail in the hearsay as to the first two homicides, but what detail there is just simply wrong. There was no radiator bag used in either homicide, and Shannon Welch testified that he heard from Welch that the radiator bag was used, and that is not true. There was not a bag used. And there was no entry through the basement windows, although a witness said that Welch allegedly entered through the basement windows. And the victims were not left on chairs in the basement, another thing that Welch had told these witnesses. And the scenarios themselves were not believable, in that in the part of Pete Adams, who was a witness, testified that, I can't remember the year offhand, but shortly after, I believe it was the second homicide, Lonnie Welch came over to his house without any prompting, asked him to come out onto the porch, and then tearfully confessed to having committed these homicides. And then instead of comforting his friend or making any comment whatsoever, Pete Adams simply went back into the house, and then Lonnie Welch just simply left the porch. This just isn't a believable scenario.
Well, counsel, are you claiming that defense counsel didn't properly develop all of this to the jury?
My argument is that the trial court erred in its ruling on the reliability of this evidence.
In letting it in at all, yes.
Counsel,
but once it was in, you're not claiming that defense counsel didn't make the same kinds of arguments to the jury that this, you know, for example, this last one, it's just not believable.
Correct. Defense counsel did use their opportunities to cross-examine the witnesses as best they could. However, it should never have gotten that far because this evidence should never have been admitted in the first place.
Was Crawford versus Washington decided during this case? I mean, the timing, and how does it apply?
Crawford versus Washington was decided after this case. Mm-hmm. And Crawford does apply here because although this is non-testimonial, hearsay, it is not testimonial, Crawford went on to cast doubt onto Ohio versus Roberts for the very reason that there is a problem in this case, in that the reliability determination of courts are unpredictable and they are inconsistent. And courts are using an anything goes standard, is how Scalia phrased it, in that it was very vague and entirely subjective, and that it was not a proper substitute for cross-examination under the Confrontation Clause. And if we examine the court's rulings for reliability, we see that it's very circular and arbitrary in this case. For example, the court ruled that Philip Anthony's testimony could come in because both him and Welch were on drugs at the time that the statements were made. However, then in the case of David Jordan, the court said because they were not on drugs at the time they were made, even though they both admitted to being addicts, that could come in. So therefore, it's reliable because they're on drugs, and then it's also reliable because they're not on drugs. And this was a problem pointed out by Scalia when he criticized the rulings under Roberts.
Mm-hmm. How do you respond to the argument that, well, this was all created by the defendant's misconduct? I think that argument is brought out by opposing counsel. So that takes it out of the rule of Crawford versus Washington.
Again, a defendant's action does not excuse the duty to use reliable evidence at trial under the Due Process Clause and the Confrontation Clause. However, Hand, in this case, did not act with wrongdoing to the level that meets the forfeiture by wrongdoing standard under 804b6, in this case, because Lonnie Welch was killed out of self-defense, or at the very least, voluntary manslaughter. And to extend 804b6 to the cases of self-defense or even negligent homicide would swallow the hearsay rule in this case. It would extend it too far. Again, the purpose of the rule against hearsay is to produce reliable evidence so that the verdict reflects the facts. And each hearsay statement must be independently reviewed. That there are 20 statements cannot be taken as proof that they are true. Each statement must be examined independently for the truthfulness of its circumstance. And death sentences cannot be given based on unreliable and untested evidence. Further, the admission of this evidence was not harmless error. Under Madrigal versus Bagley and Van Arsdale, there are five factors to consider for Confrontation Clause errors when considering harmless error. And the most important in this case is that this evidence was absolutely central to the prosecution's case. There was no non-hearsay evidence of guilt of the previous homicides. Again, the gloves worn by Lori Hand's murderer do not have Welch's or Gerald Hand's DNA. There is no evidence of financial payouts at any time from Gerald Hand to Lonnie Welch. Hand wouldn't even bail Welch out of jail shortly before this crime was supposed to have taken place. The hair on Lori Hand doesn't match Lonnie Welch or Gerald Hand or Lori Hand. And the evidence shows that Welch did kill Jill Hand with the .32 that had no prints, and he had gunshot residue from this weapon. The hearsay was central to the prosecution's case. The prosecution relied on it over 25 times in their closing argument. And the court relied primarily on this hearsay in its sentencing opinion. And it used this hearsay as the reason for giving mitigation little weight in this case, and Hand was therefore prejudiced by the admission of this evidence. The evidence cannot be both central to the prosecution's case and yet harmless beyond a reasonable doubt to Gerald Hand. And unless there are other questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Dodson. Ms. Hemeter.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court. My name is Mary Ann Hemeter, and I represent the state of Ohio in these matters. I will first talk about Proposition Number 1. The defendant, Gerald Hand, waived his Sixth Amendment right and forfeited his right to complain of any hearsay objections when he ambushed Lonnie Welch and murdered him on January 15th, 2002. I will first talk about Ohio Rule of Evidence 804b6, because the state of Ohio did indeed meet the standards in that new rule. 804b6 requires that the defendant engaged in some wrongdoing that resulted in a witness's unavailability, and that one of the purposes for engaging in that wrongdoing was to prevent a witness from testifying. We met both those prongs. As for the first prong, did the defendant engage in wrongdoing? Absolutely. I hate to argue facts before this case, but it is imperative that you understand that by the time the hearsay statements came into evidence, the jury and the trial court had already heard evidence of a very manipulated crime scene. And it started from the very beginning when the defendant in his 911 call said that he didn't know who had come into his house and burglarized him. The evidence showed forensically that Lonnie Welch was not wearing a mask and that his face was plain to see in a well-lit hallway on January 15, 2002. The forensics showed that Bob Hand was within 3 to 5 feet of Lonnie Welch when the first shot was fired at Lonnie Welch and hit him in the mouth. The forensic evidence showed that Lonnie Welch did not get any further than the foyer of the house on Walnut Avenue, that he didn't get anywhere near the body of Jill Hand. The evidence shows that the defendant ambushed Lonnie Welch and then chased him down the street. Now, why did he do this? What was his motive? We satisfied that prong as well. We didn't satisfy that by hearsay statements. We satisfied that prong of the test by the defendant's own statements. We did not have to rely on Lonnie Welch's statements. The defendant told his cell block inmate, Kenny Grimes, if there are no witnesses, there's no case. He told his cellmate, Kenny Grimes, I killed two birds with one stone. No question then, after those statements are made, that the defendant's motive to silence a witness and to murder Lonnie Welch are met. The staff notes to the Ohio Rule of Evidence 804B6 make clear that the rule extends to potential witnesses. There is no weight to the argument that Lonnie Welch had not been served a subpoena or that Lonnie Welch had not offered any help to the police officers in any of the murder cases. The staff notes make it clear that potential witnesses are covered, and they clearly rely on well-settled case law in the federal courts. I will cite United States versus Houlihan out of the First District, where they say that there's no principled reason why the doctrine should not apply to potential witnesses. There is no reason, because to allow a defendant to profit from his wrongdoing and use the Sixth Amendment as a sword and not just a shield only serves one purpose, and that's to undermine the very system the Sixth Amendment is meant to protect. So in codifying 804B6, it is clear that it was meant to cover potential witnesses.
Do you think that Crawford versus Washington would have any would change the result in any way?
Absolutely not. I think Crawford versus Washington actually buttresses what happens in this case. And I will guide you to page 62 of that decision. In that decision, the Supreme Court talks about cases where there are exceptions to the Sixth Amendment waiver issues. And they specifically say and mention the common law notion of forfeiture by wrongdoing, and they state that they accept the common law notion of forfeiture by wrongdoing. And in fact, I think as you read Crawford, it makes sense. I agree with defense counsel on one point, and that is that the Supreme Court found Roberts to be an unreliable test. What was reliable to some wasn't reliable to any. So they came up with a new test, the testimonial versus non-testimonial. We wholeheartedly agree with that test and submit to you that even under Crawford v. Washington, our case under the forfeiture, either the common law notion or the evidence rule, is met. And in fact, I would argue to you, as a result of Crawford, there has been new life breathed in to the forfeiture by wrongdoing notion. In fact, most recently in United States versus Garcia Meza, the Sixth Circuit Court has ruled that under the common law notion, state person offering the statement no longer needs to offer evidence of motive. So what we have here in Ohio is a situation where 804B6 is more stringent than what would be required under the Sixth Amendment. Having said that, one of the other points I would like to make in this case is that the state in this case not only satisfied 804B6, but we also protected the defendant's procedural rights under the Sixth Amendment, his right to confront witnesses and cross-examine evidence. We did that through the 104 hearing that is specifically required by Evidence Rule 804B6. In that situation, the state of Ohio proffered its evidence to the trial court so the trial court could ensure the 804B6 was met and that the statements were reliable. It was the dual analysis of 104 and 403. That was done by the court, and I can go through for every statement and give you a transcript cite, if you like. However, what is clear in that process is that the trial court was not rubber stamping the state of Ohio's evidence. Very clearly mentioned on several occasions where evidence was not consistent with some of the evidence. However, as a whole, the trial court still found the evidence to be reliable. I would mark the following sections of the transcript. For Pete Adams, it's pages 2216 through 2225. For Teresa Fountain, it's pages 2,575 through pages 2,620. For David Jordan, whose statements were also admitted under 801 D2E, the 104 hearing occurred on pages 2,515 through 2,554. For Barb McKinney, The 104 hearing occurred on pages 2,478 through 2,515. For Tizona McKinney, the 104 hearing occurred on 2,554 through 2,575. For Anna Hughes and Betty Evans, the 104 hearing occurred on 2,072 through 2,599 through 2,617. Clearly, the court took its time in making sure the Sixth Amendment was not violated in merely following 804B6 and going through evidence rule 403. Appellant also argues that there was collusion among the witnesses that testified to Lonnie Welch's statements. In the 104 hearing, the trial court specifically found there was no collusion among those witnesses. More importantly, defense counsel argues that there was no evidence that the defendant was aware that Lonnie Welch was making these statements, therefore no motive to kill him. That is absolutely contradicted by the facts that were given to the jury. It is clear by the winter of 2001 that Lonnie Welch was making statements about not only the anticipated murder of Jill Hand, but his role in the murders of Donna Hand and Lori Hand, and that the defendant knew about those statements because of his conversation with Shannon Welch. While it is true that Shannon Welch did talk to the defendant about getting bail money for Lonnie Welch, the purpose of that conversation was to bail Lonnie out so he could get on with business and kill Jill. The conversation went such as, you know what he does for extra money. Yes, I do, Mr. Hand. I know what my brother does for extra money, and he's done it in the past. Yes. I ask you to read those portions of the transcript carefully, because at that point, in the winter of 2001, we see a shift where the business relationship between Bob Hand and Lonnie Welch was no longer a business relationship where the defendant merely hired Lonnie to kill his wives. It became something more. At that point, the defendant knew Lonnie Welch was talking about all the murders. And at that point, he had to get rid of him. And that's when we see a shift in the relationship. The relationship absolutely existed. Again, not only do we know that by the defendant's own statements, there is a mountain of corroborating evidence that even goes back 30 years. For example, there was independent evidence that Lonnie Welch met his friend, who he would never name, at the pizza store. And when he did so, he always came back with money. We now know that Bob Hand would meet Lonnie Welch at the pizza store and that we recovered a secret office in that same area. We also know that during the spring and summer of 2001, Lonnie Welch would meet his friend, again, who we now know to be Gerald Hand, at The Rock by the VA, which is in close proximity to where Gerald Hand worked. And the people that dropped him off and picked Lonnie Welch up specifically noted he always came back with piles of money. That is independent evidence of the conspiracy in this case, and that is independent evidence of the defendant's motive. It cannot be ignored. To argue that Lonnie Welch's statements were the only evidence in this case is to ignore about another month's worth of evidence. I could sit here all day and retry the case and go through the forensic evidence at the scene, but one thing was clear at the scene. This was a faked burglary. Nothing the defendant said about the scene added up. Sure, Lonnie Welch was wearing gloves. He was coming to kill Jill Hand. He didn't know he'd be ambushed. He was wearing gloves to do the murder he was paid to do. It was cold out, and absolutely, his gloves had gunshot residue on them. As the experts in the case testified to, anybody in that house would have had gunshot residue on their hands because it's like cigarette smoke. Jill Hand, who we know murdered nobody, had gunshot residue on her hand. So gunshot residue on the hand is not dispositive as to who murdered anybody. In closing, in proposition number one, not only did the state meet 804B6, we have not violated the defendant's Sixth Amendment rights. And I would like to spend a moment on that because this is an area of emerging law. And it is an area ripe for this court to start deciding and reshaping in Ohio what is meant by the confrontation right. When we look at the confrontation right, and we could go all the way back to United States versus Reynolds in 1878, the confrontation right isn't a superficial right to confront. It means more than that. And it always has been countered by the very compelling interest of the state to get competent, credible, reliable evidence to the trier of fact. And in looking at the Sixth Amendment and looking at cases of forfeiture by wrongdoing, the Supreme Court has consistently held that the focus is on the defendant's actions. The focus is on the wrongdoer's actions. Therefore, motive need not be an issue. Having said that, we've already satisfied motive under 804B6. I think it is important for this court to note that under the common law notion of forfeiture by wrongdoing, under the Sixth Amendment, motive need not be proven by the state by preponderance, by clear and convincing, beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not an issue. I would ask you to read the Garcia Meza case out of the Sixth Circuit. Having said that, there is an issue as to what test do we use for non-testimonial hearsay. And I think Crawford led that door wide open. Some courts, out of an abundance of caution, are resurrecting Roberts and using the Roberts factors to decide whether or not a hearsay statement comports with the Sixth Amendment. I think that that is illogical, and I think that if Roberts is that unreliable and that inconsistent, we should not use it. If a statement is non-testimonial and it meets the grounds of another rule of evidence, for example, an excited utterance, a statement for medical diagnosis, then at that point, the analysis is over. The Sixth Amendment was satisfied because it's not testimonial, it's non-testimonial, and it comports with whatever state or district or whatever jurisdiction you're in, comports with that jurisdiction's rules of evidence. Therefore, the analysis is over, and it's for the trial of fact to gauge credibility and to decide whether or not the state proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt. I would ask this court to follow that analysis. As a prosecutor who's in the trenches every day, trying to figure out whether or not a witness who's been threatened, if that person's statements can come in under forfeiture by wrongdoing, or what kind of proof I need to have to get past the Sixth Amendment, it is time for this court to decide those issues. We deal every day with 911 tapes. 911 tapes in certain federal districts are not excited utterances, and they're being considered as testimonial evidence. While I agree with the analysis in that case, I practice in the state of Ohio. And I urge this court to start shaping Sixth Amendment analysis under Crawford. And given the opportunity in this case, we also have the opportunity to discuss 804B6. Even assuming error, and I am not conceding any error whatsoever in the admission of Lonnie Welch's hearsay statements, even assuming error, if we go down the Van Arsdale factors, there is no constitutional violation. Any error in admitting those statements was not harmful to the defendant. The first factor, whether the statements that are hearsay were important testimony in the context of the state's case. I submit to you that Lonnie Welch's statements were nothing but the icing on the cake. To rule on those statements solely is to ignore forensic evidence, the defendant's own statements, and competent, credible evidence that would have come in notwithstanding hearsay rules. The second factor, was the evidence cumulative in nature to the testimony? Yes, especially since the jury and the trial court had already heard the defendant's own statements that he'd killed two birds with one stone, and if there's no witnesses, there's no case. The third factor, was there presence of corroborating of testimony on any material points? Again, the defendant's own statements corroborate Lonnie Welch's testimony. There was other evidence. For example, the defendant told Kenny Grimes that Lonnie Welch had upped the price of the murder for Jill Hand to $50,000, had doubled it. We know that Barbara McKinney, in putting away Lonnie Welch's items, found a card with the number $50,000 on top and how Lonnie Welch was going to spend that $50,000. That is corroborating evidence as well, notwithstanding the forensic at the scene that this was an entirely bogus burglary scene, that this was in fact a double murder. The next factor under Van Arsdell is whether or not there was effective cross-examination. In this case, cross-examination was permitted twice, at the 104 hearing and at trial. And I submit to you, read the cross-examination. All the issues that were brought up by defense counsel were addressed by trial counsel. And again, it is the trier of fact who decides credibility. Were there inconsistencies? Perhaps. Did these people have, even though the trial court found no collusion, did these people have a reason to lie? Maybe. But the trial court put that issue to rest after the 104 hearing, and more importantly, the jury put that issue to rest in issuing their verdicts in this case. The last factor under Van Arsdell is the overall strength of the prosecutor's case. I am beginning to sound like a broken wheel. We have spent a lot of time talking about Lonnie Welch's hearsay statements, but again, those statements were hardly the soul of the case. The jury heard from over 80 witnesses. They analyzed over 300 pieces of evidence. They went to the murder scene. They heard forensic expert upon forensic expert testify as to how the scene on Walnut Avenue did not look like a typical burglary. The glass in the front window was blown out, not in. Lonnie Welch's tooth was left on the front door, and the blood spatters from Lonnie Welch were leading out of the house, not in. There was no evidence that anybody got near Jill Hand but the defendant. The only misfiring gun was the gun used to kill Jill Hand, and by the defendant's own statement, the gun he was firing. As to the scene, it's also important for you to note that there was obvious manipulation of evidence. There was a layering on the front porch of blood spatters, glass, and then some of Lonnie Welch's clothing placed on the front porch. At first glance, it puts Lonnie Welch there. But upon analysis, you start to see another picture develop. If this was a burglary, and the defendant didn't shoot Lonnie Welch until after Lonnie Welch broke in the window, how come Lonnie Welch's blood is underneath the glass that's blown out? Looks like the window was blown out after Lonnie Welch fled the scene. The jury also heard mountains of evidence as to the defendant's motive to kill Jill.
Okay, we've been listening to facts from both sides. Just humor me with the last one. Looks like the window was blown out. So that was a theory after Lonnie went out. So your theory or argument to the jury on that was what happened?
You have to tie it together with the defendant's statement that the window was blown out first. Okay, and the argument to the jury, and I'll make the same argument to you, is the sequence, you gotta tie the sequence of the 911 call. That Lonnie Welch broke in, that the defendant didn't know who he was, that he was wearing a mask, and that this person came in, shot his wife, and he chased him out the door. That was the defendant's statement. And he knows that as he chased him out the door, he shot him several times, doesn't know if he hit him, doesn't know where, doesn't know anything. If you buy that scenario, then there's no way Lonnie Welch's blood would get under the glass unless the glass was broken out second.
Unless the glass was what?
Unless the glass was broken out after Lonnie was fleeing.
All right, so your theory, that's what, condense the argument. I don't want to hear the whole argument. Your argument as to what happened.
Was that the defendant hired Lonnie Welch to kill Jill Hand.
Yeah.
However, in the winter of 2001, he found out that Lonnie Welch was not only talking about the anticipated murders.
But what happened that day? What
That Lonnie Welch
came in.
That the defendant killed Jill first. We'll start out there.
All right.
And there was evidence to corroborate that based on the coagulation.
Now he's hiding, waiting for Lonnie to show up to kill her.
Right. And he ambushes him instead.
Where?
At the front door. That's where Lonnie's tooth was found, and those were where the droplets of blood were found that we know are Lonnie's that lead out the door.
All right. And the broken glass, explain that, your version of that.
Our version is that the defendant, after shooting Lonnie Welch, after chasing him into the neighbor's driveway and shooting him while he was face down, that Bob Hand then came back out, walked in his house, and then blew out the windows to make it look like a burglary.
Okay. That's a little hard to swallow, too, isn't it?
No, Your Honor.
The guy shoots his wife, then waits for the guy he paid to come to his house to kill her, and he's planning to kill him to silence, to shut him up.
Mm-hmm.
And he shoots him in the doorway, chases him out in the yard, shoots him some more, and then he comes back and calmly shoots out the windows in the house.
Correct. What we know about Bob Hand is he's able to do this. What we know about Bob Hand is that for years before the murder was even in place.
What, I mean, wouldn't you run the risk that the neighbors are wondering, why is he shooting out his windows after he's just shot this guy out in the yard?
I'm not sure Bob Hand considers that.
I mean, that just seems so implausible.
It happened, and the jury said so. And one of the things, and I don't mean to belittle the point, but one of the things we're dealing with here is we're dealing with a person who is very manipulative.
Well, I can follow and believe your scenario on a lot of things, but then when you start telling the jury that he did all of this and he came back and shot out the windows, that makes me wonder about the jury. I mean, I don't see why anybody would believe that happened.
Well, all I can say, Your Honor, is the jury
particularly
did
you
believe it. Your Honor, all I can say is that it was a theory of the case, not just because we're making it up. The evidence led us there. Our job as prosecutors is to get to the truth of the matter. As unconscionable and as manipulative as a scene might be, when you look at the forensic evidence, there is no other way to explain how the glass was layered on top of blood.
I mean, it seems to me you could have your theory and go to the jury and just say, of this glass and the blood under it, we can't explain it and he can't explain it, rather than come up with an explanation that just sort of defies human experience.
And you and I can disagree that till we're blue in the face. That
I guess
is
we will.
Where the evidence led us.
Right.
That is the evidence that was presented to the jury, as well as the mountain of evidence as to the defendant's debts. And I don't want to sidestep that, because when I talk about a manipulative person, this is a person who racked up hundreds, thousands of dollars of credit card debt. But the only credit cards he paid off were the ones that carried the life insurance policies on his wife. And he not only paid them systematically, he paid them with certified mail. And we found that when we found his secret office. We're not dealing with a crime of passion. We are dealing with a very cold, manipulative murder here. And the person who underdid it did it with prior calculation and design. And that's why he was able to say, the burglar broke out the window. I don't know how that happened, when the evidence clearly shows it doesn't make sense. We might disagree as to the theory. However, the jury found the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Not just as to the murder of Jill Hand, but also to Lonnie Welch. I see I have very little time left. In closing, it is imperative for this court not to let the defendant profit from his wrongdoing. The hearsay statements were admitted pursuant to 804B6. The state met its standards. Those statements were also admitted consistent with the Sixth Amendment, especially in light of Crawford's acceptance of that equitable exception to the Sixth Amendment. The verdicts in this case were based on sound, reasonable, logical evidence, and not just the evidence of Lonnie Welch's statements, but a mountain of evidence, beginning with the financial debt, going through the scene, going through the defendant's own statements as to his purposes behind killing Lonnie Welch, and ending with Lonnie Welch's own statements. The procedure in this case was sound and consistent with the principles of the Sixth Amendment. To rule otherwise would only serve one purpose, and that would be to undermine the very adversarial system the Sixth Amendment is meant to protect. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hembiter. Ms. Dotson, you've saved 13 minutes of your time, which you're not required to use.
Thank you.
There has been a lot of talk in this case about the forensics that evening of the crime scene and what they show. And what they show is that there was no wrongdoing on the part of Gerald Hand. That has not been met in this case. There was a very short time frame in which the events of this night took place. And again, the state cannot say how long Lonnie Welch was in the house or where he was in the house. All we know from the forensics is that he was shot by the front door initially. That's where a tooth was found, and that's where his blood was found. And this matches Hand's statements that he shot Welch out of self-defense. And in addition, the forensics experts testified that two bullets from the door frame and the window frame, I'm sorry, the ceiling and the window frame, indicate that they had been shot from 5 feet down the hallway, where Hand says he came running out of his bedroom with two 38 guns in each hand and fired upon the intruder who had just killed his wife. Again,
well,
Hand,
if their theory is that he decided it was time to get rid of this rather efficient killer that he had employed for two prior spouses, he would know where he was when he fired the shots, so it wouldn't be that hard to make up the story of I came running down the hallway and I was X feet away, because he's obviously smart enough to know the forensics will give an indication of how far away he was when he fired the shots. It does really come back to this hearsay testimony and whether or not it should be in. If it's not in, does the state still get to show that this is the third wife that met a violent death over the lifetime of this man?
No, the state should not be allowed to use the previous homicides in this case at all. There is no link tying Welch or Hand to the previous homicides. They were not charged. The only evidence the state has for this theory are the hearsay statements themselves. And furthermore, to go back just one moment.
So if you succeed in keeping that hearsay out, there's no basis for bringing in this guy's marital history.
Correct. While it's a rather unfortunate fact, the fact is that no one was charged in these previous homicides, and they cannot be now used as other acts when the state has failed to prove that Hand was involved in these two previous homicides.
You would agree if that information could come in without the hearsay, he's probably going to get convicted anyway, isn't he?
Well, a jury cannot convict merely on suspicion or emotion. There must be evidence. There must be solid evidence that ties Hand to the previous homicides. And there simply is not that evidence in this case, because Hand has never been charged with those previous homicides. The state has never been able to find any evidence to tie Hand to these homicides. And so it cannot come in to convict him of this homicide in this case and to use that emotion and suspicion on the part of the jury. That is strictly prohibited by 404B. And there was a Sixth Amendment violation, and that the Sixth Amendment violation is that Hand had no opportunity to cross-examine Welch himself. That is the Sixth Amendment violation. It is not that he got to cross-examine the other witnesses. It is that he had no opportunity to cross-examine the declarant in this case, and that is Welch. And that is the Sixth Amendment violation that we're addressing here today.
Does voluntary manslaughter fill the category of a wrongful act? Because you've conceded he could have been charged with that.
No, I believe voluntary manslaughter does not meet the requirements of wrongdoing. Again, under 804b6, it is wrongdoing for the purpose of preventing testimony. And the two cannot be separated. There must be both before evidence can come in under 804b6.
Under what theory could he be convicted of voluntary manslaughter?
I'm sorry?
Under what theory could he have been convicted of voluntary manslaughter?
If the defense of self-defense does not continue out of the home into the neighbor's driveway, then the defense of voluntary manslaughter would then apply.
So if they don't buy self-defense and he's found to have actually chased this guy down and shot him, that's not considered a wrongful act because you claim they can't tie it to the fact he was trying to silence the guy?
Exactly. It was a continuation of the act in the heat of passion, making it voluntary manslaughter. And there was no evidence that Welch was killed to prevent his testimony. Again, outside of the hearsay statements themselves, there is absolutely no independent evidence of Welch's involvement in the previous homicides. And I believe that the state brought up Kenneth Grimes, who did testify that Hand told him in jail that I killed two birds with one stone and got rid of these witnesses. However, Kenneth Grimes is not a credible witness whatsoever. He's not credible for three different reasons. First, he did not initially tell the authorities about Hand's statement that he was going to kill the witnesses. He only told the authorities this after he had been charged with escape, or told that he was going to be charged with escape. He then came back to the authorities and said, "Wait, I have some more information for you." He also, the details he tells of the crime scene that night don't match either the state's theory or the defense theory. Kenneth Grimes said that Lonnie Welch held the gun to Jill Hand's head while they were negotiating the price, and then Gerald Hand killed Lonnie Welch. Well, that's not what the state puts forth at trial, and that's certainly not what the defense puts forth at trial. That simply didn't happen. And third, Kenneth Grimes was let out of jail after he cooperated with authorities in this case and received a deal, and certainly had motive to alter his statements to make them what the state wanted to hear. And again, there is no non-hearsay evidence, either from Lonnie Welch on the part of Gerald Hand even, that he killed Lonnie Welch to prevent his testimony about the previous homicides. And if I could correct one more thing that the state said about Shannon Welch telling Gerald Hand that Lonnie Welch had been making these statements. And I believe the state has misstated the part of the transcript that this took place. And it's at pages 2645 to 2647 is where Shannon Welch talks about going to Gerald Hand for bail money. And the best way is just to read this directly. He says, "I went in and asked him if there was anything he could do about helping my brother get out on a bond." And the question was, "You're asking this of the defendant?" "Yes." "And he told me at the time, he said, 'Well, I can't have no contact with Lonnie or his girlfriend because we got business.' And he said, 'You know what I mean?' I said, 'Yeah, you know what I mean.'" I'm going to skip down just one question. And it was, "The defendant referred to business with your brother." He said, "Yes." And the question, "Did he explain what that meant?" And the answer, "No, but from what I knew about the situation, I knew what he was speaking about." The question, "What did you say when the defendant said he didn't want to talk with your brother?" "Well, he said he couldn't help him in no kind of way. He said he didn't need to have any type of contact with him or Barbara McKinney." "Didn't need to or didn't want to?" "He said he didn't want to." "And did he say anything else about your brother?" "He told me that my brother crossed him twice and his mother once." "Crossed, was that the word he used?" "Yes, that's the word he used." The question, "Did you have any understanding as to what that meant?" And this is the important part. His answer was, "Well, as far as my interpretation of it, either they had a fallout over some money or whatever. I don't know." There's nothing in here is where he's telling Gerald Hand that, "Yes, I know what my brother does for you, and I know how he gets this extra money from you." He was simply saying that he thought they were having some dispute over money, and that's what he thought this crossing business was all about. There is no explicit testimony that Gerald Hand knew that Lonnie Welch was making these alleged statements. And in addition, if Lonnie Welch had been involved in the previous homicides, it had again been 25 years since his initial involvement. And there is no evidence that Gerald Hand took any measure before this to silence Lonnie Welch. So it's kind of defies explanation why he would wait this long now. Surely he had to know the police would identify Lonnie Welch in his house that night and realize that they had been friends for some time. So again, the forensics of the scene itself support Hand's theory that he was shot out of self-defense, or at least voluntary manslaughter, in that Lonnie Welch came over and shot Jill Hand. And in conclusion, Gerald Hand is on death row because the state was permitted to use unreliable and inadmissible hearsay against him. Had the Welch family not been allowed to testify, the state had absolutely no proof of Welch's alleged involvement in the previous homicides, and the state's theory crumbles. And it's important to look at the quality of evidence, and not the quantity in this case. There was ample testimony about his financial practices and the forensics, but the only evidence tying Welch into being a witness and that he was killed for the purpose to prevent him being a witness is hearsay. And the admittance of this hearsay was not harmless, and this court must vacate Hand's convictions and death sentence.
Thank you, Ms. Dotson. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.